Welcome to the last talk of today here in this room. Emil will show us something about processing and process permissions. Welcome.
Hi, and welcome to my talk, Molding Sand, Shaping Permissions of Processes. First, some things about me. I'm Emil, I go by any pronouns. I'm currently converging towards insanity because I'm studying pure mathematics. I'm contributing to free and open source projects since 2018. I'm loosely involved with Curl, RosenPass, and Tor. Especially RosenPass is like the reason I'm giving this talk, because we are trying to implement a privilege-separated architecture into the software. And yeah, I'm a connoisseur of the band The White Stripes, which is why I have to base my outfits entirely onto them. And yeah, so what is the motivation behind this talk? I was a lot into this in early 2021, probably. I've also wrote a privilege-separated POP3 daemon at one point in the time. I haven't published it because I suffered from strong perfectionism during this time. And for some reason, people in my environment think I'm knowledgeable at this. I would say I'm good at learning, but I'm even better at forgetting things. So this talk would probably not be perfect. When I did the slides, I realized how much I forgot throughout these years, but I still did my best, so bear with me. I have some acknowledgements. Many thanks to Henning Brauer for OpenNTPD. We will do a case study of this particular program later on in this talk. Then to Christoph Johnsons for his talk, Bugs Ex Ante, which was given almost exactly 10 years ago. It served as a good inspiration for this talk, but many things have changed ever since. And also many thanks to Jan in the front row, who gave me the title for this talk. So yeah, let's do an introduction. Some questions for the audience. Who of you write software? Raise your hand. Okay. Who has bugs in their software or thinks their software has bugs? Okay, good to know. Who has software that runs on the internet? Okay, this is a little bit creepy because the intersection of the people who just raised their hand with my software runs on the internet and with my software has bugs is quite the same, actually. To summarize it, your software is broken. And to summarize it even further, people will exploit your broken software in the most ugliest ways imaginable. Just a question, has anyone ever, or was anyone of you ever responsible for a vulnerability that has been exploited? Okay, there are some. It's okay, I also do mistakes. Just a thing, if you have any questions, just raise your hand and we'll answer them. Okay, yeah, this is fine. Okay, what can we do about this? So first, we can write defensive code. What this means, I will explain later. We can audit your code. We can get 100% branch and MCDC coverage. We could use up-to-date libraries. We could formally proof our code. Has anyone experienced with that or has done that in the past? Okay, someone. So I see a hand. And we can also write to work with our magic unicorn. If we are honest with ourselves, there are like two viable options only, because getting your code audited, it's extremely expensive, and sometimes, or in many cases, the code is, at least in some parts, very hard to read, very hard to understand, and even if others look at it, they might not fully understand it. 100% branch and MCDC coverage is also possible, but it costs quite a lot of money. And sometimes it's very, very hard to achieve because, as you might know, testing, like, some things in the software are very, very, very hard, like testing an out-of-memory error or something like that. But in order to achieve 100% MCDC coverage, you even have to cover these cases. Using up-to-date libraries, it may sound like an easy thing, but sometimes there are newer versions with breaking changes, and this sometimes breaks the entire architecture, and as you know, legacy sticks around. I mean, we still have IPv4, so And formally proving your code is like, it's also an option, but it's really, really expensive. There is a formally proofed kernel called SL4, and if I remember correctly, the cost for proving a single line in this source code was around $400, but I'm not quite sure about that. So yeah, it's also an expensive option that falls away. So we are effectively only stuck with this option, writing defensive code. What does defensive code mean? On one side, there is static code analysis, such as the Rust borrow checker. They are quite nice. They do the jobs and certain things well, but they never can catch all possible vulnerabilities. Using fuzzers or making your code fuzzable is also a viable option. And what this talk will primarily deal about are APIs provided by the operating systems in order to make your application more secure. What do I mean by this, and what are some common misconceptions? Those APIs will not prevent your vulnerabilities. Your remote code execution will still be there. Your buffer overflow will still be there. What it will reduce is the impact that it might have. For example, if you would have a remote code execution and wouldn't use such an API, it might happen that an attacker can do anything on your system. But if you might have such an API, or if you might use such an API, this might just be reduced to a fairly little share of what they can do, maybe fetch the operating system time and that's it. So yeah, it will not prevent the vulnerabilities, but it can prevent the possible damage. Another thing we can do is structure the program in logic in separate logical units. This is called privilege separation. We will talk about this later in the talk. And this talk will not cover applied sandboxing mechanisms such as systemd, analyze security, or bubble wrap, or what else is there. What we will cover are the APIs that these tools use. So basically, after this talk, you might create your own bubble wrap or something. But yeah, so let's start with a demotivative example. My favorite is our file system permissions. Who of you has screwed up their file system permissions at least once? Oh, yeah, I see almost all hands going up. Who of you knows when file system permissions were initially introduced? Yeah, down there, at the back. Almost. I give a better hint with a picture, which shows how old this actually is, because file system permissions were introduced the same year the Berlin Wall was built, in 1961. Which is very interesting, because we suck at this still 6 years after. And yeah, almost everyone has screwed them up at least once. And the octal codes are very hard to understand, and mostly they are just muscle memory, effectively. And yeah, security can be very hard. Now we will talk a little bit about the kernel sandboxing APIs, which make your application more defensive, and they are the ones that are provided by the kernel. First things first, certain APIs are very complicated, and some of them are very unportable. They usually operate on processes and all of their future dependencies. And the general rule of thumb is that it gets easier the lower you are, the closer you are to the metal. It's easy in Zig and C. It's doable in Rust and C++, but it's almost impossible in Go, Java, and Python because you are so far away from the operating system at that point. And yeah, the question we must always ask ourselves when we use these APIs are, what can an attacker do when they gain full control over the process? Like when we have a remote code execution, which allows an attacker to do anything. This is the thing we always have to keep in mind. We always have to keep in mind that we do mistakes, and these mistakes can lead to the ugliest things imaginable. Before we look at certain APIs in particular, let me coin two terms. As a disclaimer, those terms were coined by me. They are not used by anyone else, at least not right now. So there are basically two types of these APIs. One are limiting, and the others are isolating. The limiting APIs basically remove capabilities from a process, and they restrict system calls. There is strict system calls, sometimes in their general availability, sometimes in their arguments, sometimes in their behavior. And isolations are a little bit on the other hand. They remove visibility from the process. Like a process can still do all the things it could done before, but it basically has a different view on the operating system and the shared resources in general. And basically, yeah, it hides resources from the operating systems away from the process, such as files, folders, subtrees of the file system, network interfaces, other processes, users, and so on. Here's an overview of the sandboxing APIs. So the earliest we've got was setuid in 1971, and the latest edition we will cover is the Landlock API introduced in 2021 by Linus. I've highlighted them in the colors by the type they are, like the blue ones are limiting and the purple ones are isolating. So let's already start with the setuid system call. It exists since the first Unix version, and please do not confuse this with the setuid bit you might find in some things such as sudo. What the system call does is that it basically changes the owner of a process. In Unix, each process has a user, and the user associates a process with a certain set of privileges. For example, the super user, the root user, gives a process basically all possible things. And then other users give like access to certain system resources. And by that, I mean basically file system permissions. That's the whole point behind it. This system call requires root, and it's the foundation for privilege revocation. Privilege revocation means you have privileges, you have a large set of privileges, and reduce them during the span or during the lifetime of your program. A quite common thing is that a process starts as root and then drops to a normal user after the things that require root are done. It's still common today, although it was advanced throughout the years by things such as a real and effective UID. And the primary use case for this API is when a program only needs root during initialization. Here's a small code example that we can often find in production. A very good example are sockets, because when you create a socket and want to listen on a certain port that is below 1024, you usually require root privileges. A web server is a primary example. It wants to listen on port 80, and maybe if you use encryption, I mean, who does that? Who needs secret? Maybe 443. And what it does is basically you create your socket that requires root. Afterwards, you change the user of the process to an unprivileged one. In that case, we set it to the user ID 42. And if that fails, you should panic, because continuing as root is always a bad idea. You also want to change the group ID of a process. A process also has a group ID, because yeah, files also have group permissions, and you don't want that to be associated with the previous group. And yeah, then you can basically handle the requests, because they no longer require root. Any user can basically do that. Here's a sample output of such a thing, basically. You start a process as root, and then after some time, it eventually drops to a normal user. You see, it's still the same process ID, but a different process owner. OK, then we talk about another option that is also very old and exists since the late 70s, chroot. First things first, chroot is not a security mechanism. It is a convenience mechanism. Sorry for breaking your reality at that point. And what it does is basically that it changes the root directory of a process and all its future children. So it's only from then point onward, it only sees a certain subtree of the file system. It works very simple, and it has some weird side effects, because it is not a security mechanism. It's a convenience mechanism. A primary thing is that it does not affect already open file descriptors. Like if you have opened a file descriptor that lives outside the subtree, it will remain open. And it's very hard to use securely, actually. And the wrong usage of this thing even leads to new vulnerabilities. Like when you use it the wrong way, you can cause great damage. That's why calling it requires root, because you sometimes can gain root privileges as an unprivileged user if it's done wrong. What's the use case? Yeah, basically convenience. I will now show you the most trivial and easiest chroot exploit, so you can see that this was never meant as a security mechanism. The most trivial example of an exploit is the following. You chroot a directory, and then basically go upwards, 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 as much as you can go, basically, and then chroot back to the now current working directory. This is possible because the chroot system call does not change the current working directory. So when you change your root to sandbox slash, your working directory will remain at that point where it was before, so in the directory where sandbox was. Yes. So a small thing, a small fix would basically that calling to call basically chdir directly after you've called chroot. So can we still use that securely? Are there some ways, are there some precautions, like some rule of thumbs we can use in order to use chroot securely? And turns out, yes, they are. The first rule for using chroot securely is don't use chroot. And the use case, basically it's considered to be an okay defensive strategy if the process at no point in time needs file system access, and the directory that is being chroot to must be empty and owned by root, so no ordinary user can create files in it, modify things in it, it must stay empty. Many systems provide /var/empty for that, which basically satisfies the above criteria. Later on, we've got capabilities. Those were introduced around 2000 in Linus. They can be used externally and internally by processes themselves. Like I said earlier, we only deal with the internal mechanisms, how they are used internally. And what this security mechanism basically does is to associate each root operation with a certain capability. So previously it was like you had your root user, which was able to do anything, and with capabilities you are able to restrict things a little bit down. So basically, an example capability would be the cap.net.raw. Like when you want to create raw sockets, you need that capability. Another one would be the cap.sys.chroot for using chroot. I've mentioned earlier that chroot requires root privileges. So when you use them, your process continues to run as root, but it behaves like a normal user in all operations except the ones for which you have privileges. For example, if it would only have the cap.sys.chroot privileges, you would be able to call chroot, but that's it. You would not be able to reboot the system, you would not be able to create raw sockets, you would not be able to change the system time, because again, although you are root, you do not have the capabilities at that point. And a use case would be the process only needs a subset of root privileges until termination. Like we couldn't use setuid here because, for example, the process would need that privileges not just during the initialization, but during its full runtime. An example might be an NTP client. Like it needs to set the time, it just needs to set the time basically. That's the only root related operation it has to perform, and it has to do that during the end. This looks a little bit complex, this code example, but bear with me, it's possible to understand. In order to use capabilities in a program, you basically have to initialize an internal data structure and add the capabilities you want to this just initialized data structure. There are the set of permitted capabilities and the set of effective capabilities. What this means is the permitted capabilities constitute a superset of the effective ones. Like the permitted ones are the privileges, are the capabilities, pardon, that the process can use, and the effective ones are the ones that are currently effective right now and can be used right now in order to call functions. So yeah, in this example, we just use the cap.sys.chroot capability, and we add it to the permitted and effective set, and then we perform this call in order to apply them to the current process. Now we can free this data structure because, yeah, in C we have to do your memory management manually. And now we can see chroot will work. It will not return a -1 call, but the reboot system call, for example, will fail because you do not have the capability to reboot the system, although you are the root user. A small fun fact, the magic numbers you see here, this is the birthday of Linus Torvalds in ASCII, and hexadecimal, pardon. And those are the birthdays of his three daughters, which is a cool Easter egg, and the man page also mentions that those values are not meaningless. Yeah, now let's talk a little bit about jails. They were introduced in 2000 by Paul Hennenkamp for FreeBSD. And they are essentially CH-root, but for real isolation and for real security. They are basically the OG container solutions. They existed 10 years prior to Docker, and they can isolate an entire subtree from the system, or basically they can isolate anything away from the system. They can also be used externally, but also internally by the processes using an API, and it usually requires root because the set of active jails is a global system resource, and global system resources are usually only should only be modified by root. The use case is basically to isolate something like a VM, but without the overhead of virtualizing an entire CPU. Wait, isn't this a little bit like Linux namespaces? Yes, it is, but there are some differences which I want to point out now. They basically offer similar end goals and were introduced around the same time, but namespaces are a little bit more fragmented instead of monolithic. For example, with namespaces, you have the PID namespace that behaves, that has its own main page, the network namespace, the mount namespace, the process namespace, C group namespace, there are dozens of it. But the biggest difference is that jails start from full isolation that can be liberated further upon, whereas namespaces start from zero and you have to build your security up. And from my experience, namespaces are a little bit harder to use. I had to work with them professionally for a year or something. For example, file system isolation usually requires around 7 steps to perform using the mount namespace, and the network namespace is still barely documented, unfortunately. Yeah, that's how it is. Here's an example of using jails. Warning, this is deprecated actually because the initial API we've had for jails only permitted basically network isolation and file system isolation, but it basically now allows you to emulate. Emulation is the wrong term, but to isolate all parts of a FreeBSD system. Basically, you have this data structure, and the interesting things are the root of the jail, where you want to, I don't want to say chroot to, but you get what I mean, what the root of the jail basically constitutes. And we can also pass an array of IPv4 and IPv6 addresses we want to delegate to the jail, but if you don't want to do that, we don't have to. And yeah, then we can call jail, and now we are jailed. Now let's talk a little bit about SecComp. It was introduced around 2005 in the Linux kernel. What it does is that it basically provides a whitelisting feature for system calls, and you can filter entire system calls just by their name or number, they're technically numbers, and you can also filter them by their arguments, which is very cool. So you can, for example, allow the open system call, but only allow it with the capital O underscore read only flag, so that you can only open files for reading, but never for appending, writing, or anything else. And those whitelists can be reduced, but it may never be expanded. Once you've given up on a system call or one of its arguments, you can never get it back during the entire lifetime. So an attacker could never gain those privileges back. A violation of that would result in the process getting immediately killed by the operating system. And unfortunately, each system call has to be whitelisted manually. This provides very high security when you do it properly, but it comes at the cost of a very high complexity, because even a very basic hello world usually always require lots of system calls. Like you require the exit system call, obviously, you require to allocate some memory because printf needs memory, you need to write to standard output, and there are probably some more I don't have in mind right now. Those are just the ones that come to my head right now. And unfortunately, it's very unportable, at least in C code. I'm not sure, has anyone ever used SecComp in C here? Okay, that's very fortunate, you don't want to. Because when you see it in production, you see so many C preprocessor flags like, do this when you are on Linux and are on x86 underscore 64, or this if you are on ARCH64, because system calls differ quite a lot depending on the architecture. And other things are related to the fragility of the Linux ecosystem in general. Fork on glibc is a very good example. So on glibc, the fork system call is not implemented by fork. Instead, it implements the system call using the clone 3 system call, if I remember correctly. So when you see a fork call in your code, you see it, and you then would think like, yeah, I would allow this with seccomp, fork, edit, and it would still not work, because under the hood, it used something completely differently. That's not very nice to figure out, trust me. And yeah, the use case of it is to, when your process only needs a specific subset of system calls, which basically applies to every program. Yeah, I can't provide an example for that, unfortunately, because even the most minimal example I could think of would not fit onto a single slide. But I would have to refer you to the seccomp manual page. It contains an example at the bottom there. That's somewhat easy to understand, to put it briefly. There are some BPF instructions, actually, which I do not understand. But yeah, that's how it is. A thing that FreeBSD offers, which is extremely interesting from an intellectual point of view, is Capsicum. Because, as you can see, it's not just limitation, nor just isolation, it is both. This blew my mind away the same way I learned that particles, or that objects can be particles and waves at the same time. Still not over that. Yeah, it was introduced in 2012 for FreeBSD, and what is magical about it is that capabilities are based upon FIDO scriptors and not just processes. And what you do when you want to use it is basically you put your process into a so-called capability mode, where from that point onwards, only system calls that have at least one file descriptor in their arguments are permitted. And then each file descriptor has a different set of capabilities, and because the and from now on only system calls with a file descriptor as its argument are allowed, you can do the isolation through that way. An example is a file descriptor that may be read and written, but not fchmod. Because on Unix, in theory, everything should be a file. So there's quite a lot that you can do with file descriptors. The use case is obviously to isolate resources away, as well as to limit capabilities in general. Here's a bridge in case, because I found this so incredibly amazing that limiting and isolation, which are actually far away, can work together with this. You will now see a code example, which is just so cool. It might look a little bit frightening, but it's possible to understand. Basically, before you enter the capability mode, which we will do here, we open a file descriptor to a directory. That's the isolating part, because with that we can isolate to a directory. You will soon understand why. And then afterwards, we enter the so-called capability mode, from which point onward we may only use system calls that accept file descriptors as one of the arguments. This, you can see this here. The open system call will fail, because it has no file descriptor in its arguments. However, the open add system call will work, because it accepts a file descriptor as its first argument, which is the directory file descriptor we've opened here. And with this, we can basically open a file in that directory, because we are referring to it using the DRFD file descriptor, and that will work. And then further onwards, you can even limit this file descriptor you've just opened by initializing an internal data structure used for this entire process, and then specify the capabilities that it may perform. There are many capabilities. This is just cape underscore read. It basically allows reading on a file descriptor, but there are so many others. There's not just write, there is also like cape underscore mmap, if you want to allocate memory. You can do lots of things with file descriptors. And then you can, yeah, you basically apply that limitations, and now you will see reading from that file descriptor will work, but writing will not. And seeking will also not, but that are just not all things you can do with file descriptors, basically. And yeah, here's also a summary. Basically, open the directory that shall be available, enter the sandbox, which we did here, open the files in the sandbox, which is done here, and then finally restrict these files. And now let's talk a little bit about Pledge. And this is like basically your hope from that point onward, because Pledge is actually, in my opinion, the first API, except set UID maybe, that is actually easy to understand and very easy to use. It was introduced by OpenBSD in 2015. It's now also included in Serenity OS. And it's very easy to use, you will soon understand why, but yet still very secure. It's just a single system call, no other functions, just a single system call with two parameters that are strings. And what it does is basically that it's quite similar to SecCom, but much more easier to use. It reduces, it reduces the set of available system calls, and a process will get sick killed once it violates this. However, the system calls do not have to be whitelisted manually. Instead, they are grouped into categories. For example, there's a category of STDIO-related system calls. RPath basically means system calls related for reading from the file system. VPath is the same, but for writing. Internet-related system calls. There are also DNS-related system calls, and so on. And this is not just pure whitelisting. For example, standard input has to include a read system call because you may want to read from standard input. But RPath needs to do the same because you want to read from files. So it also limits them in the behavior flow. So if you have the read system call available here, you cannot read on file descriptors when they are in arguments if the file descriptors read from files on the file system, because that's not allowed. It also restricts them a little bit in their behavior. And the use case, again, is the same with SecComp. The process only needs a specific set of system calls during its lifetime. And that's basically all of it. You call pledge with a set of privileges. You usually require monitoring the initialization of a program. And then, for example, let's read a configuration file. And from that point onwards, we are done. We no longer need file system access. Then we drop that privileges by calling pledge again, but with one keyword less. And then we can do like web server stuff if we are web server or something. Now let's talk a little bit about Unveil. Unveil was introduced in OpenBSD in 2018. It's also available on Serenity OS now. These devs really have taste for good APIs. And what it does is that it removes the visibility of the entire file system the first time you call it. And then you call it again, but with paths and with paths as their argument and the way on how to use these paths. So when you call it the first time, all files are gone, except the files you've just added during the list of available paths. And once you're done, you call unveil again with two null pointers to basically prevent further usage of the system call. And this already achieves a great level of security, because basically, the worst thing that can happen is that an attacker gets full control of a process and can make write changes on the file system, because at that point it can put itself into the system permanently by copying itself to various locations. And if this capability is excluded from the first time or from the beginning, it helps a lot. And the use case, you can probably already derive that by yourself. The application only needs certain paths in the file system. A small code example is here. Basically, we make two files visible to the process, the config file for reading, a log file for writing, and then we prevent further unveiling of paths. And now we can see that we cannot open the /root/.ssh/authorized keys for appending, because we have not added it to the set of known files. And what will happen here is that we get an error indicating that the file has not been found. It will not result in a sick kill. Instead, the file is not found because the visibility of those files has been hidden. And future calls to unveil will also fail now because we've prevented this with this. So we cannot just enable sudo for read and executing because unveiling was prevented. And now we come to Landlock, the last API we're going to deal about. Landlock was introduced in 2021 for Linus. It still provides no glibc wrapper, unfortunately. And what it does, it's basically Unveil for Linux, but a little bit more complicated, but also more fine-grained, on the other hand. And an application in the beginning basically specifies a global rule set of permissions that applies to all restrictions it will now perform upon, such as this application only needs read access, or this application only needs write access, or this application only needs the permission to create directories, and so on. And then the application gives each path a subset of these permissions, which will then be allowed, and then other paths cannot be accessed. This offers a more fine-grained control. Yeah, like I mentioned, it offers a more fine-grained control, such as it's not just reading and writing files, it also applies to directories, symlinks, sockets, and all other things imaginable that might lie around the file system. This is very complicated, I know, but it's like the largest piece of code that still fits onto a slide, and I'm thankful that it's somewhat readable on the Beamer. What we do basically is we define a set of the available permissions, then we configure the permissions for each path, then we prevent new paths to be allowed, and then we finally enter the sandbox. This works here. With this, we allow the process the global set it may can do, in this case, reading and writing files. And then we create a file descriptor that is basically serves as the internal data structure for this. And then we open some files, we do not open the files directly. We actually get a file descriptor that does not refer to the file, but refers to the path of the file. So this is like some meta thing you have to wrap your head around. And once this is done, you basically set this file descriptor to an internal data structure, and also define the permissions for this file descriptor. In that case, we only want the config file descriptor to be read. And then we add it to the internal data structure used for landlock. Now we can close that file descriptor because, again, it just refers to the path, not the real file. We do the same, but with the write privileges for the lock file we've opened here. Then add it to landlock. And now we prevent with this PRCTR call that further calls can be done. So we basically say, OK, this is now fixed. No further changes are allowed. And then we apply it. And then only these paths can be accessed using these permissions we've just gave them. And yeah, now you can see we can open that file for read only. It works fine. We can open that file for writing only. It works fine. But if we want to open the config file for writing, it will fail. If we want to open the log file for reading, it will fail. If we want to open root SSH authorized keys for appending, it will fail. And yeah, a basic summary of these APIs is that complexity is the worst enemy of security, unfortunately. Most technologies we outlined are unfortunately terribly complex and sometimes over-engineered. Over-engineered in the sense that they offer sometimes very good security at the cost of ease of use. And if they are hard to use, not many people will use them. And this is not very nice. Why is it so bad? I will leave that to you. Here we can also see a graphic of the complexity and the security offered by the complexity of using it. SecComp is at the extreme. It offers very good security, but it's very hard to use. And Patch is somewhere in the middle. OK, are there any questions? Just maybe now, because we will talk about a different section then. OK, sweet. Either I just rocked it or failed completely. Yes, sure, go ahead. Yes, they are isolating. Have I said that they were limiting?
No, you didn't demonstrate them at all.
Oh, yes, I've compared them to jails because I thought they were easier to use and talk about a slide, because in the end, they want to achieve the same.
Okay.
Like the difference is just in detail. Okay, yeah.
For those of us who may be not graced with working in the holy language C, is there any way of achieving a similar level of security, say, for example, on the JVM or other compatible machines?
It depends. It depends a lot. Like I've mentioned in the beginning, it's... The closer you are to the operating system, the easier it gets, because you have to interact with the operating system and the kernel directly, and Java abstracts so much things away at that point. Limiting system calls, like what seccomp and pledge do, that's probably hard to achieve in the JVM, but isolating things, such as isolating the file system, that's probably easier to do, although I do not want to... Okay, thank you. isolating file system paths is probably easier, but again, you can easily make mistakes there because maybe your JVM loads modules dynamically from paths you haven't allowed, and then things will go wrong. So yeah, it's easier the closer you are to the metal. Yes. There's another question.
Hi, thank you. Can you mix and match these security mechanisms, these sandboxing mechanisms?
Like, you mean mixing them?
Yeah. Yes. Two different. Yeah?
Exactly. You can do that, and that's also done in production actually. Okay. For example, when you allow the open system call, you usually also want to permit the set of files you may open. So it makes sense to combine them.
I meant especially like if I remember correctly, you have seccomp and capsicum or whatever, and those are two isolating ones, right?
So you can't combine them because one is Linux and one is FreeBSD.
Okay.
Yeah, so in those cases, APIs offering, again, this is sometimes highly unportable and very operating system specific. And in these cases, you can't mix them because they aren't available. Yeah. Okay, now let's talk a little bit about privilege separation, what this is, why it's related to the previous thing I've just talked about, and why it's very cool. What's basically motivation? Sandboxing is usually done on process level. However, especially with server processes, you then have very big and monolithic processes that do lots of things. And in that case, they would require lots of capabilities, lots of privileges, lots of permissions. And if they have such a large set, such a large chunks of permissions, it's almost not helpful anymore. And the idea is to basically split a process into small child processes and let each of them do just a single task, like the basic Unix philosophy. And this offers much more fine-grained control because, again, sandboxing is usually done on process level, and you can isolate each of these smaller processes in a very fine-grained fashion. Okay, let's do a small graphics here. We will talk a bit more about NTB daemons later on. A good example is an NTB daemon. Yeah, it runs as root in that case because it's red and it's dangerous. And when you have a privilege separated daemon, instead of having just one process like we did before, we now have two. We have a supervising root process and an unprivileged process running as a normal user. The normal user in that case would probably perform the parsing because, again, if you have a security vulnerability, it's much likely always the parser in like 95% of all cases because that's where most things go wrong. And then once the parsing is done, you just send an 8-byte Unix timestamp back to the supervisor, which then actually sets the operating system time to that new timestamp. So in the worst case, if an attacker controls this process, it can just send an arbitrary timestamp. Well, lots of things can still go wrong with that in a more combined fashion, but still the attack surface is greatly reduced. So what is the history of privilege separation? It's very nice to understand, or very helpful to understand in that case. The preliminary work was done by DGB in 1995 with Qmail. Just curious, has anyone used Qmail here? Oh, yeah, I see. I'll say that's cool. It was very innovative back in its day. Because what made it so much different from all other mail daemons back then was that it was not a big monolithic process. It consisted of a set of many tiny processes that each did a small thing. And in that case, just one of them was running as root, and it just did the bare minimum required, which required privileges. Two of them were local user. The rest of them were fully unprivileged. Here you can also see the QML process architecture. Like you have this one root process and two of them as the local user. Yes, these two. And they all communicate in a nice fashion with each other. And yeah, but this was not privilege separation in itself. It was more like just process separation because these processes were not really sandboxed with these APIs I've just mentioned before. The initial implementation was basically OpenSSH around 2002. With the work done by Niels Provos and Markus Friedel, both from OpenBSD. And in that case, there was an unprivileged child process that processed all of the network data. The communication was achieved using pipes, and the authentication only happened when the child and the parent agreed that that things are valid. So even if a child was fully corrupted, no authentication circumvention could have happened. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the fork architecture. Are you familiar with the Unix process architecture here? Because this slide will give a brief introduction to that. Okay, I see thumbs up, that's good. So in Unix, processes are usually structured as trees. And a process can use the fork system call to create an exact copy of that. When it does that, everything this process owns is copied. File descriptors are copied. Heap allocations are copied. Variables are copied. Basically anything, everything is copied. And then the control flow is branched into two branches. This is done in the by the mechanism that the parent receives the PID of the child as its return value for fork, and the child receives zero as the return value of the fork system call. As a small note that's quite good to know is that often processes get PID 1 as the new parent and not just their grandparent as the new parent, which would make sense, but that's not the case. And the fork API leads to funny Google search queries such as how to remove children from parent using fork. Here's a small example of using the fork system call. Basically, you call it. If it returns minus one, it's an error. That's a common convention in Unix system calls. If it's zero, you are the child. And if it's the if it's anything else, it's the PID of the child and you are the parent. So that's basically how the Unix process architecture works. Now let's talk a little bit about inter-process communication. It's closely related to threads communication. Has anyone of you used or programmed with threads so far? Okay, nice. Who of you shot themselves into the foot using threads? Okay, nice. And yeah, Unix offers gazillion ways for IPCs. They offer signals, sockets, pipes, shared memory, the file system. And those are just a small subset of available APIs. I'm now going to make the bold claim and say that Unix domain sockets are the best choice. At least, yeah, in most cases, because they are very fast. They offer high speeds because they are in the they only happen in kernel space. They allow file descriptor passing, which is very powerful. So one process can basically send a file descriptor to a different process, and then the receiving process can use that file descriptor. That is very useful for passing TCP connections around because they are also file descriptors. They are atomic in nature because you just read them, read data, it's gone, and those kind of things. And messages can be distinct datagrams, which are easily distinguishable. And if you use Unix domain socket, I will talk about this a little bit later. Here's a small example of Unix domain sockets using the child-parent architecture I've just introduced on a previous slide. Basically, you create two sockets using the socket pair system call. What it does is it creates two sockets which are connected to each other, so if you write to one socket, this data can be read on the other end, and vice versa. Then you basically fork the process, and on the child, you close one of these file descriptors, and on the parent side, you also close one of these file descriptors, because again, when you call fork, everything is copied, including these two file descriptors, and you only want one of these processes to own one of them. And yeah, now you can send data from them. So in that case, the child would send data onto to the parent using maybe a string or arbitrary data in general. The parent will receive it, and yeah, that's how it works. You may maybe this looks a little bit weird. It's because you should use a library for that. You do not want to use sockets or Unix domain sockets without a library. I'm quite curious, has any one of you ever passed a file descriptor using Unix domain sockets without a library, like this real send message, send receive, receive message system called? Okay, you've enjoyed that? Okay, I see. I see. Yeah, it's in my opinion, Unix domain sockets are like the, or at least the file descriptor passing is one of the APIs I hate most in Unix, alongside signal handling and ptrace. It's a cursed mess. And libraries, usually they are basically the same. They provide a generic message format with a header and a payload. They guarantee that messages are received in order and as a whole. They do some buffering around those things. They perform a very nice abstraction for file descriptor passing, because doing that by your own using the plain Unix POSIX API, it's not fun. And yeah, possible libraries are iMessage from OpenBSD, 0MQ is also quite popular, there are quite of them. It's not worth mentioning them all, probably. I personally like iMessage from OpenBSD, it's just 500 lines of C code, and I like if I can audit my libraries. And yeah, this is basically privilege separation, and we will now do a case study about OpenNTPD, which is a sandboxed and privilege separated NTP daemon, for those of you who don't know what NTP is. It's basically the protocol that is used to fetch system time and to synchronize your system clock with an upstream source. Why should we study an NTP daemon? NTP daemons offer the perfect attack surface when you think about it a little bit closer. It implements an insecure protocol from 1985. It's completely unauthenticated, no TLS. Just very insecure. It needs root privileges all the time because it needs to set the system time at the end of its request, so you cannot drop that from early on. It usually starts as one of the earliest processes in the system, so you can compromise the system directly at its start, at its begin, at its startup. And they usually also run 24/7. And a remote code execution here could have very disastrous consequences. So yeah, why should we study OpenNTPD? In my opinion, it implements privilege separation very well. I have learned a lot from its code base when I learned this 3 years ago. It's only about 4,000 lines of C code, which is an amount you can audit in a doable time span. It has only had one CVE, at least if the code base is good. It only had one CVE in 21 years. It has very clean code, and I had a friendly email thread with its author during the authoring of the slides. Hi, Henning. Yeah, and its architecture basically looks like that. You have this one privileged root process that is sandboxed using pledge to only call set time of day. Then you have an unprivileged process that performs the NTP request using sockets, and then also includes the parsing. These two are file system sandbox, that's why they have these boxes around them. And the NTP process itself spawns two other child processes, one for performing DNS requests. This DNS one is not fully file system isolated because it needs to read etc host and the other files related for DNS requests. And another one is a constraint process. This one has a purpose that is quite useful, because what it does is basically that after it fetched a date, it connects to an HTTPS server, a trusted HTTPS server, and there is an HTTP header called date, which provides the system time of the server. And the constraint process basically checks if the just received timestamp from the unauthenticated NTP source matches roughly the timestamp returned by the trusted HTTPS source. So a big difference, an attack would usually fail at that stage. And then they communicate with each other. So the constraint process basically receives from the NTP process the received timestamp and would then return, OK, everything's OK, to that process. With DNS, it's quite similar. It would provide a host name here and would return basically the resolved IP addresses. And with root, it's just the, yeah, it's just the timestamp that was then fetched. Yeah, and that's basically it. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Emil, for this very interesting talk. So we have still some time left. Are there any questions left?
Hi, thank you for the great talk. I have a question in regards to portability of OpenNTPD. What they're using instead of Pledge for Linux, or is it just skipped?
I have to admit that I do not know about a specific port. But I could imagine that they have either they have completely removed it. That's like the easiest solution. You just remove the Pledge API and it's gone, because removing it is quite easy. But I could also imagine that that's probably a port that uses seccomp, because again, the code base of OpenNTPD is not that complex and it's quite known what they should do. But yeah, it's probably seccomp for the Linux port.
Hello, thank you for the talk. I understand now a bit more, but I'm still a bit confused as well. I'm not writing C, so I have quite the same question as before. Maybe I'm not getting the realm of these things correct, but there's things like jails in FreeBSD to isolate other programs and not my own. And there's like fire jail and other attempts. Is this also the realm you are talking about? Are you capturing other programs basically inside your C and then later call them, or how is this working?
That's what I meant. That was what I meant when I referred to that these APIs can either be used internally by processes or externally used by processes. When I was referring, I basically only cover technologies that were at least usable internally by processes. And the idea was that processes basically isolated themselves so that they are secure by default. And yeah, this is, in my opinion, a hill worth dying on. Jail, like you mentioned, with fire jails, or what was being called, it's also possible to use it externally, for sure.
One more question.
I might be misremembering this, but I think it's possible on Linux with file capabilities to get a process which isn't root but has capabilities. Is that correct? And if it is correct, wouldn't this be a much better way to get a process with reduced capabilities so that it doesn't even need to be root?
That's a very good question, thank you. The best answer I can give is to refer you to the man page. While you mentioned it, I also slightly remember that there was probably something around that. Like, I remember you could set capabilities using the file system, actually. There was something in that direction. Maybe you are right with that, but I can't really tell, so please look into the manual page. But yeah, if that's possible, that's actually a much more secure way, because even if you are root and only have zero capabilities, it's still quite powerful, because the root user can read, has still the file system permissions, like it can read the private keys such as in the etc SSL directory, which is not quite desirable.
Yes. I can give you an answer to that. You can use file capabilities to achieve that, but it's even easier. You can just combine the setuid call to drop your user ID from root to a non-privileged user. But doing some capability magic, you can keep your capabilities and then drop the capabilities you don't want. So you can also have this way a user account, a user that is not root and still has some capabilities. That's what most container engines do, for example, or Firejail and so on.
For the nice answer.
Any more questions? That doesn't seem the case. I guess Emil will be available later out in our space. Oh, then thank you again for having this talk and have a nice evening.
SPFM.